Today, we are largely an information and service economy nation. But just the generation before that, a production-oriented nation. And before that, an agricultural-oriented nation. Today, all of that is converging, one local business at a time, when consumers buy local. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, a look at the pros and cons from the consumer angle of buying local, plus the implications for a local economy when consumers don't buy local. Our panel of guests will help us sort out these pluses and minuses of a larger bottom line. And we want to meet you, our listeners, at the checkout counter of this discussion. We want to know from you, Kansas City, where do you shop locally and why? And aside from price, what makes you forego a local business and instead go to a big box retailer? That's coming up on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. Good morning, Kansas City. It may seem uncanny today to remember and consider that Walmart, Target, Best Buy, and other big box behemoths were all at one point in the 1960s small businesses, supported locally. Today, they're called category killers, a term stemming from the decimation of small specialty businesses. Business history and economic development is funny that way. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today, we discuss the pluses and minuses of buying local and the lasting effects on our economy and future economic development. We'd like to welcome our panel of guests, beginning with Judy Ansel, Professor of Labor Studies at the UMKC Department of Economics. Judy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
We also have Kendra Fink, a manager at 10,000 Villages, a fair trade nonprofit location in Overland Park. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Professor Linwood Taheed, also with the UMKC Economics Department, specializing in, among other things, community economic development. Welcome to the show, Professor Taheed.
Good morning to you and your listeners.
Let's begin with you, Professor Taheed. When you look at Kansas City, the disparities between the east and west sides, the remaking of Main Street, and our surrounding suburban sprawl, what type of environment are you seeing for local businesses?
Well, what we're seeing, and you mentioned the east-west divide along Truce. What we're seeing and have been seeing is significant development in areas outside of what used to be called the inner city. But we see very little of that development spilling over into the inner city. And so this is historical. It's not limited to Kansas City. It's a national phenomenon. So Kansas City is not bucking any trends in that way.
But what does that mean then for local businesses?
Well, I take the position that that part of that process, which affects the city as a whole, which is most cities' drive to attract large retail, also has that same increased effect on inner city development. It has an effect on small business in the city overall, and so that effect on small businesses is magnified in the inner city.
How does that mixed market of big box retailers on the outskirts and local businesses sparsely populated in the urban core or any inner city, as you call it, how does that affect the entire local economy as in the metro area?
Well, one of the things, I mean, there are a number of ways of thinking about this. If you just think of it into and break it into a producer-consumer paradigm, you can't no community can be only consumers. You have to produce things. And small businesses that either produce a product or a service are very important in creating revenue into that that community. If you're a consumer, the revenue obviously is going out of a community, more or less, depending on where that service or good is produced. But no community can be only a consumer of things. You have to be a producer. You mentioned that at the beginning, and this is important as we go through this discussion, is that all large businesses start out as small businesses. So if you don't have a small business base, you'll never develop large business. And even if your goal is to develop large business, you can't develop that if you have no small business base. Only thing you can do is buy from businesses, large businesses from elsewhere that have been developed. So.
And one of the themes that keeps coming back is mercantilism, this local circulation of dollars versus capitalism when maybe a larger company is entering a new market. Talk about the difference between mercantilism and capitalism, and we'll go to Judy Ansel to talk about how this affects the labor market right after that.
Okay. The term mercantilism is an old term in economics, going back at least to the 16th century.
In the Renaissance period.
Right. And that period in economic history, particularly in European economic history, was a period in which the belief was that the wealth of nations depended upon the amount of gold that was in the federal treasury or the king's treasury, and which meant that the countries of Europe were all vying to get more revenue in than went out. Of course, that can't happen for all countries. And so Europe ends up fighting not only trade wars but actual physical conflict as a result of having this idea that the wealth of the country depends on how much gold is coming in. Adam Smith, in fact, is generally considered the father of capitalist thought, although he never used that term. But in fact, The Wealth of Nations, written by Adam Smith, was a refutation, a critique of mercantilism. And the outcome of that, what Smith was trying to show was that the wealth of nations didn't depend upon the amount of gold in the treasury, but depended upon the productivity of the people. And that mercantilism, which was an arrangement between the monarch and chosen chartered corporations, you know, the government would choose a couple of big box corporations, I'll use that term, to do trade between nations and within nations. And small businesses that were producing the product were just producing and selling. But they could only sell to the large merchants. They couldn't sell to customers directly, particularly in other nations. And Smith's critique in The Wealth of Nations was that this middleman effect of a government-sponsored big business was, in fact, decreasing the productivity of small producers, and that these middlemen, these merchants, needed to be removed from the system so that individual small businesses could trade with their customers and with each other. That would increase the productivity, and that was the real wealth of nations.
And as he speaks of Adam Smith also coined the term the invisible hand.
That's correct.
About letting the market take care of itself. And how is that invisible hand working, Judy Ansel, for our labor pool as we examine small business versus big business and how it affects the local economy?
Well, it's not working very well for workers. It doesn't matter whether you've worked for a small business or you work for a big box. wages for retail workers are depressed, and in fact, in Missouri, wages for retail workers between 2007 and 2010 went down 5.6%. The minimum wage, of course, hasn't been raised in 3 years. It's way behind what it was in 1968. I think it's if the minimum wage had kept pace with the cost of living, it would be up to $10.50 an hour, and it's only $7.25. So for retail workers, their lives are pretty tough. And if you're making decisions about where to shop, certainly a good question is, you know, how much are the workers making and are they treated fairly?
Certainly, and you bring up some very poignant points. Real income has remained stagnant over the past...
Well, actually dropped in the last decade.
Right, yeah. Stagnant to in a doldrums for the last couple of decades.
Right.
So how does that affect production in terms of the labor force?
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, you know, we could talk about shopping locally, but where's the stuff made?
Right.
And, you know, we're going to talk to Kendra about a shop that actually is concerned about not just where the stuff is made, but how it's made and the conditions of the workers. And, you know, it's guaranteed that if you're going to a big box store, the stuff is probably coming from overseas, and that's not good for the local economy. So you really need to ask the question, where is what you're purchasing made? And if it's made overseas, under what conditions?
And politicians, Judy, are always talking about small business being the lifeblood of the economy. How do these local statistics and the local atmosphere for small businesses, for the labor force, what does that say about the economic structure of Kansas City?
It's really hard to find a small business to shop at. You know, I mean, I have a few on my list that I try to patronize, and I try to ask those kinds of questions. But in fact, you know, most things we need, you can't find a local business that sells them. and we're forced to go to these bigger places for many things, many items.
And what environment has created that?
Oh, well, it's not just local policy. It's national policy that's created that. It's our trade policies in particular that treat any good, no matter how it's produced, under what conditions, as if it was produced in the United States. And so it gets free entry into our market, including the products of child labor. There are no restrictions on that. You know, we've had a series of trade agreements. We're negotiating another big trade agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership right now, which will eventually incorporate China and Vietnam. And so we're going to be in one world market with one world labor market where conditions for the workers are appalling in some of the places where we get our stuff from. And that drives it.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Today, we discuss the pluses and minuses of buying local and the lasting effects on our economy and future economic development. Our guest panel is Judy Ansel, whose voice you just heard. She is a labor professor who lectures and teaches at the UMKC Department of Economics. Kendra Fink is a manager who we're going to hear from in just a few moments at 10,000 Villages, a fair trade nonprofit in Overland Park. And Professor Linwood Taheed, also with the UMKC Economics Department, specializes in, among other things, community economic development. Kansas City, where do you buy your local retail goods? Why do you not buy local goods? And when do you make these choices? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also join the conversation at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option. And we now turn to Kendra Fink, a manager of 10,000 Villages, a fair trade nonprofit in Overland Park. Define fair trade and tell us about your store.
Sure. Well, at our store, we're a fair trade nonprofit retail store. So we have products from artisans from about 40 developing countries. The artisan sets the price for selling the products to 10,000 Villages. And our organization has been around since 1946, our national organization, and our store in Overland Park has been there for about 12 years. And so what we do is we focus on paying a fair price to the artisans who are producing different products. So we have a variety of things in the store, jewelry, home decor. We also have fair trade coffee and chocolate and other fair trade food products. And so fair trade is not just about paying that fair wage. It's also about environmental sustainability. It's about considering the working conditions that people are making goods in. And so it's really about focusing on long-term relationships that are based on mutual respect between the people who are producing goods that we consume and the consumers.
Factoring in the externalities, so to speak.
Right, yes.
Overland Park and other suburban places around the country are awash with retail chains and restaurants and establishments. What are the challenges you face at 10,000 Villages, and how do you navigate that environment of big box, little boxes that all look the same? Mentalities of suburban places all around the United States.
Sure. Well, I mean, definitely at our store, we have a unique mission, selling fair trade products, selling very unique products from such a diverse group of people, from different ethnic groups, different cultures. We have many, many different products in the store. And I think that definitely sets us apart. And people, you know, our regular customers, our volunteer base, our mission is very important to those individuals. And I think that people want to, you know, when they're going out and when they're purchasing something, they want to know that their purchase is having a positive impact. And I think people are focusing on that more and more.
What makes 10,000 Villages unique enough to compete in this big box era?
Sure. Well, we have products that are really of a high quality. And I mean, in terms of our home decor, our jewelry, they're wonderful pieces. They're unique. Many of them are made out of recycled materials, which just makes them very, very unique, wonderful products that people really want to purchase. And when people are coming to look for holiday gifts, for gifts year round, they really come and they think of us. And, you know, we consistently have customers who come back again and again just because of the mission of our organization and how much it means to them.
We're talking about buying local and its effect on the local economy in a global world. Noel tells us via email, I try to buy locally produced goods. Unfortunately, I see tax incentives for large businesses that often bring foreign materials, for local production. Our municipal governments do not seem to give the same tax incentive to small local businesses as they do to large big box retail outlets or manufacturers. The problem is, unless you offer tax incentive to large business, they will not build their new office or plant in your city because every other city is offering such incentives. If all cities stop offering tax incentives, we'd be seeing more small businesses in the Kansas City area. Very interesting point from Noel, Professor Taheed. The tax incentives, the wooing
right.
of business interests to our American cities.
Right. It's a significant factor in the question that you asked, Judy, about what's causing this this devaluation of small business and the rise of large business. It's the fact that governments want large businesses. They woo them. In fact, you could actually reverse it. Small businesses have agents that market them to various cities and compete them against each other. They're actually competing cities against each other. For this, the promises is always that we will produce so many jobs. And so you have a large business that comes into town with a project saying we're going to produce 500 jobs. You don't have 50 small businesses that have banded together and say we're going to produce 10 jobs each. That's 500 jobs. Why don't you support us? But the figures are demonstrative. There's an estimate that the cost to taxpayers for tax abatements for small for large businesses is over about $20,000. I'm averaging that about $20,000 per job, and the tax support for that was large businesses. Tax support for small businesses is about $2,000 per job.
Judy Ansel, you had something you wanted to add.
Yeah, and one of the effects of this is that we're subsidizing low wage jobs. You know, my own opinion is that we shouldn't use any tax subsidies for retail. I think it's really counterproductive, and I think the results in Kansas City itself has shown that you're basically robbing Peter to pay Paul when you do that. I remember the Walmart store at Blue Ridge Mall that got subsidized to open, and the day they opened, they closed the one in Bannister Mall. The fact is, you know, 60% of low-wage workers work for large corporations that employ over 100 people. And we've had a real decline in enforcement of our labor laws in this country now for three decades. And many of these corporations, particularly Walmart, are leaders in violations of labor laws, and they get away with paying workers nothing. Those workers then cannot contribute to their communities in shopping, in building houses, in all sorts of things. So it's a policy that is guaranteed to have devolution of your economy rather than any kind of economic development. And so that side of it, the fact that workers are misclassified, we're increasingly having a temp workforce, one that can't unionize. And you know, if you really want economic development, you want to encourage unionization because unionization makes for a stable workforce that can afford to buy things.
We're talking the pros and cons of buying local and the consequences of not buying local for the area economy with our panel of guests, Judy Ansel, a labor researcher at the UMKC Department of Economics, where she's also a professor, Kendra Fink, a manager at 10,000 Villages, a fair trade nonprofit in Overland Park, and UMKC Economics Professor Linwood Taheed is also here. Why is it important then, Linwood, to buy local? How does that add to the solution?
Well, part of the solution is that buying local keeps money, keeps dollars circulating in the local economy. You can't buy everything local, okay? There are things that you're going to buy that you don't produce. And by the way, I think the discussion should not only go to buying local, it should be to producing local,
right?
Right.
Right.
Because you can buy local of things that are made elsewhere. But in that discussion, if you are buying local, you're buying from your neighbors, your community, your family, and so that keeps money circulating in the economy longer than it would if you just simply bought directly from somewhere else, which has what's called a multiplier effect. It will produce local jobs.
You have anything to add on that, Judy Ansel?
No, I think it's absolutely true.
You think it's absolutely true?
Yeah, and I think we should pay more attention to where we produce stuff.
You're talking about dealing with artisans who actually do produce stuff. Some of them are local. Can you talk about that? Kendra Fink?
Well, with 10,000 Villages, the mission of our organization and has been since 1946 is primarily to work with artisans in developing countries. We do have some products in the store that were produced in the United States by a job creation and job skills training program for women. So we do have those products in the store. But, I mean, it comes back to the mission of our organization and what it has been since 1946 and just ensuring that those artisans who produce the products have been treated fairly and, you know, making an impact in their lives. And, you know, it is important to, you know, support local businesses and local production as well. But the mission of our organization is focusing in those countries.
Kansas City, do you buy local goods? And if so, why? Do you not buy local goods? And when do you make these decisions? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also join the conversation at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, and we're on Twitter at KCURCST. We're going to go to Stuart in KC Mo right now. Stuart, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello there. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I've been in business here in Kansas City for about 5 years now, and recently moved location. And when I moved location, one of the things that I wanted was a retail store. I'm a furniture maker and antique restorer. And in the retail store, we do have a few antiques, English and American, but predominantly all the new things that are in the retail store, I really wanted to focus primarily on local craftsmen. And so we have a lot of home goods that are built right here in Kansas City, not just in America. You know, I wanted to give these guys an outlet to be able to show their work and to support them and to help them along with the amazing quality of work that they do.
Thank you very much, Stuart, for your input. This is an interesting conundrum we have here because Stuart and, of course, 10,000 Villages, our guest here, Kendra, these are artisan goods produced by artisans and, in a lot of cases, luxury items that people can buy local and afford to pay that premium on locally produced items. Talk about that conundrum.
Well, I don't think it's a conundrum. I mean, if the idea is that these are luxury items, persons with a certain income can afford them, but they're buying them from artisans.
Right.
And those artisans are going to go out and spend their money locally with ordinary people. And so even that flow of money creates local jobs. It's not just a matter of luxury goods are only benefiting the wealthy. I mean, they're receiving the good, but they're creating revenue into the economy.
Is that circulation measurable, though? Let's say an artisan makes a fine chair and sells that chair, takes that money. They live in an outlying area, and they get most of their goods from Best Buy or Walmart.
Right.
Technically, it is still a local circulation of the economy, but technically.
The circulation like that is measurable. It takes some time. It takes gathering some data to do so. But these kind of economic impact studies have been done. And they do show that more money circulates in an economy when you buy from a local business than it does when you buy from a big box. As an example, in 2002, the city of Austin did an economic impact study. Borders Bookstore wanted to come into the city. They wanted tax abatement, tax increment financing, and so forth. And to Austin's credit, they did an economic impact study. The result of that was that they concluded that about 13 cents of every dollar spent with the Borders would stay in the local community. That would have displaced two local businesses, one called Waterloo Records and one was Book People. And the economic impact of those two businesses was that about 45 cents of every dollar spent with them stayed in the local community. So we're talking about more than a threefold impact of local business circulation as opposed to large business circulation.
Is this a good model to look at, Kendra Fink?
In terms of us being a business that's locally operated and being, you know, right here in Overland Park, I know that a lot of the, like, when we go out and purchase, when we do volunteer appreciation events for our volunteers, we try to purchase locally as much as possible for the food for those events or the gifts or whatever it might be. And we really, you know, we not only do we enjoy having a place in the global economy through what we do as an organization, we also enjoy being part of the local community. Another thing we do is community shopping events for local nonprofits where we give a percentage of sales back to a local nonprofit as well. So we enjoy, you know, being part of a local community, and I do think that that's an important part of what we do in addition to being a global citizen as well.
We're talking about the pros and cons of buying local and the consequences of not buying local for the area economy with our panel of guests, Judy Ansel, a labor professor at the UMKC Department of Economics, along with Linwood Taheed, a professor of economics at UMKC, and the voice you just heard, Kendra Fink, a manager at a fair trade store, 10,000 Villages in Overland Park. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, more on this subject. Kansas City, why do you buy local goods? Why do you not buy local goods? And when do you make these choices? 816-235-2888. You can also join the conversation at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us at KCURCST. Central Standard returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We now continue our discussion on the pluses and minuses of buying local and the lasting effects on our economy and future economic development here in the KC metro area. Our guest panel is Judy Ansel. She's a professor who is a labor researcher and expert who lectures and teaches at the UMKC Department of Economics. Kendra Fink is a manager at 10,000 Villages, a fair trade nonprofit in Overland Park. And Professor Linwood Taheed is also with the UMKC Economics Department, specializing in, among other things, community economic development. Kansas City, when, where, and why do you buy local goods? And why do you not buy local goods? And when do you make these choices? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also call us through the email. You can call on us through the email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, and tweet at KCURCST. Professor Taheed, when you look at the local service business, barbershops come to mind. Local food shops come to mind. It's kind of a no-brainer. But when you look at a hardware store versus Home Depot, that's also a no-brainer for some people. Now, how do a small business navigate this disparity between a consumer good and a consumer service, which is more palatable locally? Talk about the difference in that.
Well, I mean, there is no, like, overall or just one way of doing things here. A local hardware store, for example, can buy locally made tools. Those tools have to be made somewhere. But you're not going to make all of the tools that you're going to sell in the hardware store locally. And so there's analysis that has to be made of what things you can make and sell locally and what things you can't make that you have to buy from other local communities. I mean, you know, it's not necessary that you buy any tools from large retailers. I'm not suggesting that you not do that. I'm just saying in terms of how you might organize an economy. You have thousands of local communities, each of them perhaps making various tools. And if you can set up a way of communicating, of networking between those local businesses around the country, you can, at any of these hardware stores or retail outlets, you can have any of the tools that you need. Those tools would have been made in a local economy, even though it's not your local economy. As opposed to, for example, many of those tools being made outside of that, for example, national economy. And I'm not suggesting that you put borders around the U.S. and prevent products from coming in. What I'm suggesting is the focus on big box retail and foreign production means that the U.S. Itself becomes a country of consumers, and that is not sustainable. You cannot sustain an economy if you're only buying things. You have to produce something.
About 70% of GDP as it stands in the U.S. is definitely a consumer economy. Judy Ansel, how does that difference play out with the labor pool and salary structures of a consumer business stacked up against the service component? You're not going to necessarily drive 80 miles to a barber, but you'll do that for Walmart or Home Depot or Lowe's or something like that.
Well, you know, just one comment. I mean, one of the things that would distinguish a hardware store from a big box between and a locally owned one is service.
Right.
And I know I shop at a couple of locally owned hardware stores because I get better service than I do at a big box. But then you have the question of, you know, can they afford to pay the workers, you know, anything decent? And that's a conundrum. However, if you look at wage structures at places like the big box hardware stores, they're not so good. You know, and the real question is, you know, to me, whether or not the workers have any facility to organize to improve their working conditions. The big box stores tend to be the most anti-union stores there are, whether it's a Walmart or a Home Depot. They are going to do everything they can to prevent their workers from improving, even though they might have the profit margin in order to be able to pay wages and benefits. And so you don't see a big difference there.
Conversely, and because of this, many small businesses struggle to provide the type of living wage and benefits because of the stiff competition and price structures of big box retailers. Talk about that.
That's true. However, there are small businesses who manage to provide a decent working environment for their workers. You know, even our local grocery stores, a number of them are unionized, and those workers have pensions. They have paid time off. They have predictable schedules, and they get treatment that any worker deserves. But, you know, in many of these big stores, you don't know when you're working this week. You don't know how much money you're going to make this week. They have created this part-time workforce that has no job security and no security of income at all.
And, of course, the issue, Professor Taghi, mm-hmm. is the average consumer, they don't care. They don't care about that.
Well, the average consumer cares about the price and the quality
right.
of the
exactly.
product.
Exactly.
But the average consumer with a little more insight might understand that the price of the product, even if it's a little higher, has benefits in terms of being able to employ local folks. But I don't think you have to make that choice. An author named Michael Shurman, S-H-U-R-M-A-N, wrote a book called The Small Mart Revolution, How Local Businesses are Beating the Global Competition. And the $2,000 tax subsidy for small business versus the $20,000 tax subsidy for large businesses comes out of that book. And let's take those figures. We're talking about $2,000 versus $20,000 per job. If you just added $10,000 of subsidy from local government to a small business, that would put that subsidy at $12,000, still versus $12,000 versus $20,000. In that $20,000 subsidy, you could get increased wages, you can get health care, you can get additional benefits. And so cities themselves, if they're making that choice, would be better off subsidizing small business jobs than large business jobs, not only for the increased wages, increased quality, lower prices, but also things like health care and education would benefit as well.
Let's get Kendra Fink back into the conversation before we go to our callers. Kendra Fink, you're a manager at 10,000 Villages, a fair trade nonprofit. How does your nonprofit status, your special nonprofit status, as technically a chain that's run locally by a local board of directors, affect the way you approach your local business?
Well, one thing that does set us apart and make us unique is that we have 4 paid staff at our store, and the rest of the sales associates, board of directors, people who might help us with our recycling and a variety of different things are volunteers. So we have about 65 volunteers at our store. And that's, you know, that's been something that's been very important to our entire organization since its existence. The organization started back in 1946 with one woman and has grown to this larger organization. And so that's something that we hold very near and dear. And our volunteers enjoy volunteering their time so much because they believe in the mission of our organization and take a lot of pride in it. And you definitely see that when you come into the store. You see how passionate our volunteers are about the products when they sell them.
And this is very interesting, Kendra, with your unique status. How do you navigate the traditional structures of the business in terms of customer relationship management, inventory, pricing, all of the stuff that is very germane to for-profit and retail and any local establishment? How do you navigate that with a 501c3 structure?
Sure. Well, our customer service is something that's very important to us and always has been for our organization, and definitely training and all of those things. You know, I think we take a lot of the same steps that we would if we were any other retail business in terms of customer service training and purchasing inventory and things. You know, the main difference being that the revenue that we have from selling our products goes to obviously our operating expenses, and then any revenue on top of that goes to furthering the mission of the organization. So, for instance, with some revenue that we just had, we were able to open up a new store in Lawrence. So whatever revenue that we have in addition to that goes to furthering the mission of our organization, which is to provide markets for those artisans.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Today we're discussing the pluses and minuses of buying local and the lasting effects on our economy and future economic development. Our guest panel is Judy Ansel, a labor professor at the UMKC Department of Economics, Kendra Fink, whose voice you just heard, she's a manager at 10,000 Villages, a fair trade nonprofit in Overland Park, and also from the UMKC Economics Department, Professor Linwood Taheed, who specializes in, among other things, community economic development. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We want to know from consumers in the express lane of this discourse, business owners, why do we have to be reminded to support local businesses? Why do you think we have to be reminded to support local businesses? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also join the conversation at centralstandard@kcur.org, as well as on Twitter at KCURCST. Let's go to Alex in Kansas City, Missouri. Alex, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for taking my call, Jabalani.
No problem.
And to respond to your question, why do we have to be reminded to shop local? I don't know that it's, for me personally, I don't think that it's a reminder. It's a lack of resources. A lot of times when we talk about buying local, the topics that come up are trinkets or artisan type of things, beads and that sort of thing. Well, you know, to be honest, I'm not really in the market for a wreath or a piece of jewelry. Not to take anything away from that, but, you know, I'm going to need to buy some hand soap and some tires and maybe a new ottoman, you know, practical things. But there is no resource where I can go and say, you know, what is the local manufacturer's tire? Because to me, it makes no difference if it's Cooper or Goodyear or whatever brand. It's not being able to support perhaps my neighbors in Kansas City or in Nebraska who make Dawn dishwashing liquid as opposed to someone else. And I know that it's not the case that we don't make stuff. We've got 2,500 manufacturers in Kansas City and 7,000 across the state of Missouri. So we make a lot of stuff here. It's just I don't know what it is. I'd love to buy it. I'd love to help out my neighbors. But how do you find out?
Thank you very much for contributing to the conversation, Alex. Professor Linwood Taheed, as that question is posed to our listeners, why do we have to be reminded to buy local? There are lots of local boosting, such as KC Buy Local initiatives. Why do we have to be reminded? Why is it important?
Well, I think your listener was correct in pointing out the fact that he doesn't know what's going on. And I think that points to a process of advertising public information of local businesses, what's available and so forth that needs to be made. And the small businesses cannot rely on anyone else to do that for them but themselves. They have to organize. They have to get together, create directories, and get out their message that these various things are produced locally, that they'll have higher quality, that they'll have better service, and so forth and so on. So it's up to the local businesses to toot their own horn.
And it is sort of a conundrum or dilemma, because if you want to buy a Chester drawer made of fine oak, you know exactly where to go. You might need a toothbrush, though. Maybe not know where to go. Judy?
Yeah, well, you know, we've had a national economy in this country since at least the 1880s, and we now live in a global economy. And realistically, I think it's good to know what's local and to support your local economy. But unless we focus on raising standards around the world, we're not going to be doing a whole lot. And I think it's really important for consumers to be conscious, not just about where things are produced, but, you know, under what conditions, and use that consciousness for their shopping in everything, whether it's toothpaste or whether it's trinkets. And, you know, there is information out there on the Internet that you can find out about working conditions and whether or not your dollar is going to be used to enhance anybody's economy, because economies circulate and dollars circulate around the world. And the most important thing is that it's not produced in a sweatshop. And so I think supporting the fair trade movement, supporting the movements of workers all over the world, supporting good trade agreements, it's political. And I think that we have to be more conscious of that.
Nicholas in North KC, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning, and thank you. I just wanted to add that, you know, I think a lot of what's necessarily not specifically identified but kind of danced around is, and it was mentioned a little bit, you know, we've had an economy for the past couple 150 years that were really incentivized in the U.S., one state and one United States city competing against another United States city. And in this day and age, you know, we've got incentives, whether one state's a right to work or one state has a tax, you know, advantage to come to Kansas over Missouri. But at this point, I think the United States as a whole should really readdress it's not Kansas against Missouri and Iowa against Michigan. It's the United States against other countries as an entire country. And I think that approach is somewhat antiquated, and it really makes us unable to focus on what truly is causing the problem of cities and states pulling businesses from each other.
Thank you very much, Nicholas, for addressing that comment and this conversation. Judy Ansel, you have something to say about that.
Well, yeah, I don't think it's, you know, it's not the United States against everybody else. It's working people. And we have monopoly corporations that are dictating not just to us, but they're dictating to those poor workers in Bangladesh who got burned up in the fire. And they're, you know, they're dictating around the world, and they have too much power. And, you know, it just seems to me that we have to understand that competition in this sense is not serving anybody's needs, but the most voracious of employers and businesses. Support businesses that treat people right.
Kendra Fink, what's your background in business, and what are your thoughts on some of these conversations about the global impact of local goods and services?
Sure. Well, I've been involved in the fair trade movement for quite some time now. And, you know, I've had the opportunity actually to work directly with fair trade cooperatives and artisan groups. I worked with a group in Ghana. It was a group of women, and they were making beads out of recycled glass. And the things that I really saw with that group of women is, you know, prior to fair trade, their only option was really to, you know, twice a week, they'd take their beads, they'd take them to the only two bead markets in the entire country and try to sell them that day for whatever they could get just that day, you know, without regard to, well, what was my cost of raw materials to produce these beads originally, or how long did it take me? Am I being compensated for my labor? And now with fair trade, they have this market that's opened up to them. And, you know, fair trade, part of what fair trade is a means to alleviate poverty in developing countries. And so, you know, that part of it's very important. And there's people producing goods in the United States all over the world. And I think it comes back to what Judy said. We just, you know, we want to think about whoever produced our goods and are they being treated fairly? And it is a global economy. You know, the goods that we have here in the United States are from all over the world. And so I think it's just important to, you know, come back to Judy's point and remember that, you know, we need to think about just how the people who produced the goods were treated.
Brian tweets at KCUR-CST, and this is a very salient point from Brian. Larger businesses provide convenience, i.e. everything is in one place, large inventories, which also sometimes trumps the moral imperative. I think, more often than not, given our economy, that this almost always trumps the moral imperative with a 70% consumer base as part of a gross domestic product, and therein lies the issue. When you look at, for instance, the controversial Power and Light Entertainment District, what are the challenges and factors of developers who are setting up planned communities that include anchor big box retailers and sort of homogenizing the consumer environment convenience?
Yes. I mean, you mentioned the Power and Light District, and that project had a thorough analysis before it was implemented. And the analysis of that that was given to city council, part of that analysis came from former Mayor Mark Funkhauser when he was the city's auditor. was that this was going to eventually create problems for the city. It would possibly put the city in financial straits. In spite of that warning, the Kansas City went on and did what it did in terms of developing that area. And now that the economy is in a recession, we're seeing some of those chickens coming home to roost. The city is on the line for billions of dollars of tax of city-backed bonds. The project is not performing. And what happens, you know, if you look at the entire city, Power and Light District, as a big box enterprise, when those enterprises fail, then there are thousands of people who are put out of work. If the money, about $4 billion that was put into that project, were instead put into, 1,000 small businesses, it's unlikely that 1,000 small businesses are all going to go out of business at the same time. And so some of them will fail, but many of them will succeed. Some of them will grow bigger and so forth. And the impact on the city in terms of its tax revenue and so forth would be much less. There's much more robustness in a large number of small businesses versus putting your hopes and dreams on one large enterprise.
Especially when you look at cities, though. Is it an advantage to be in Overland Park versus being in the Kansas City Crossroads? Is that an advantage?
Well, I mean, being a nonprofit, you know, I can't speak to any of the like the taxes or anything to that nature. But
simply from a revenue perspective, is it an advantage?
Right. I mean, you know, I do think that our location in Overland Park has been wonderful for us because that's such a thriving downtown area, and I think it's been great. I having not lived in Kansas City all that long, I can't really speak too much to that, but.
Charles emails us in from Prairie Village. Is a hardware chain with local headquarters and multiple locations in several states still considered buying local? Very interesting question. How about one of its non-local locations? If you live in that location, are you then buying non-local? I think this is an interesting question that a lot of consumers need to clear up. I'm going down in the Northland to go to Walmart. I'm local. I'm buying local.
well, Walmart is local to Little Rock, Arkansas.
Exactly.
Right? That's where its headquarters is.
Bentonville,
yes. Arkansas. And so when people buy products from Walmart around the country, perhaps even around the world, revenue flows into Bentonville from that. It profits flow, revenue for marketing, for advertising, for legal services, these other kinds of admin services, all of that flows into Bentonville. So it is economic development for Bentonville. It's actually a drain on other communities.
Doesn't it also, though, depend on who owns those? I mean, it may flow into Bentonville, but then it's going to flow to the owners of Walmart, and
right.
They may live in other places. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Are economic and commercial developers in the area and in America at large mostly courting large anchor tenants and big box retailers? And if so, how does this affect local businesses or the incentive for people to buy local? For instance, if you have Best Buy coming, that gets touted over Tawheed, Knishes and Greens and Judy's Hats for Bats.
Right.
Which are very interesting businesses.
Neither Judy nor I will have the money to go down and lobby the politicians down at City Hall to get our project done. Nor would we have, for example, you know, the EDC, which oversees a lot of this kind of development, requires a $25,000 upfront fee for anyone with a project, a local project. It's not likely that Judy's business or I would have the $25,000 to possibly invest in getting city support for our project, which probably will not come, you know, so we're at a disadvantage.
If you make hats for bats, you might not have $25,000.
You might not.
Right. But, you know, this depends on policy. And it depends on having leaders, civic leaders, who have a vision that's different from just a bunch of malls and big box stores. And certainly there are cities around the country who have done that and who invest in what's called Main Street and the development of small businesses, which serve the needs of people who live in an area. And, you know, I mean, when I grew up in the 50s, I grew up in a neighborhood outside of Chicago where we had local stores you could walk to, and they were locally owned. And the money did stay much more in our community, and it just seemed like the quality of life issues were a whole lot better.
This is an interesting thing to look at going forward. The market research shop Five Star Equity says Best Buy mobile stores are projected to double. By 2016, Walmart looks to build up to 100 small box stores, and this year Target looks to open up several city Target locations. So big boxes are recognizing the local need and the walkable neighborhoods and the market holes in inner city neighborhoods and coming in. How does this affect development? How does the aspect of this and the prospect of this affect
development? Well, the subsidy from city government to even the small box Walmart will be greater than a subsidy to a comparably sized small business. And so that means that city taxpayer dollars are flowing out. You get less in return. And, you know, one of the problems, of course, with the small box or small mart Walmart is that they open and close as well. You know, they come and go. They move where they're expected to get a higher profit. And when they move, they leave 100 people out of work instead of 500, but it's still devastating for a community.
Judy?
Yeah, and there's another aspect, too, which is when you have local business owners, they have a different role in your community as civic leaders, as donors to charities. In many ways, they become part of the life of your city that an absentee owner like a big box store wouldn't have. And I think that's a whole other ramification of this that we haven't even talked about.
And we are about out of time, but to accentuate the point, Chris in Midtown says, Casey isn't thinking creatively about using its abandoned space. And I think that's something that we'll be definitely looking at going forward. We've been talking about the pros and cons of buying local and the advent of big box stores and how that affects the economy, tax incentives, the global marketplace, very complex issues that affect us right where we sit. Our guests have been Judy Ansel. She's a labor professor at the UMKC Department of Economics, Kendra Fink of 10,000 Villages, a fair trade nonprofit in Overland Park, and UMKC Professor Linwood Taheed. Thank you all for joining us today on Central Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can find our podcast archives and a lot more at kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow for the food critics as they shout and whisper about the noisiest and quietest restaurants in KC. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Our executive producer is Bill Anderson. Kim Noble is behind the boards as our announcer, and Emily Muter manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney, and the outro you're hearing right now is by The Wilnots. Up to Date is next with a chat about holiday stress for divorced blended families. That plus the weekend to-do list. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.